Welcome to Nell and Matt's Obsolete Movies, the podcast where we revisit movies from our 20-plus years of collecting films on obsolete formats, basically films of the VHS era, or films available during the VHS era. And for our film, and our film for this episode is one, I think, very VHS era, 1994's The Crow.
I think, wasn't this, like, mandatory everybody had to see The Crow? Like, it feels
if
like...
If you were Gen X, this was mandatory. Like, you are not a good Gen Xer if you have not... You might not have seen Star Wars. You should see The Crow. I mean, yeah. Right? If you were our age, if you were born in the 70s, you've seen The Crow, or should have. So we don't have to do the extensive plot summary, finally, this time, I think. Because you've at least heard of this film, probably. And we have it on a busted Laserdisc. The things we had to do this podcast.
I think we started at around 8 o'clock, and we finally finished watching it at midnight.
Yes. there was lube, there was isopropyl alcohol, and finally, like sellouts, we had to stream it on HBO Max. So the last 20 minutes... Just the last 20 minutes.
We should mention two Laserdisc players.
Two Laserdisc players, screwdrivers, lube, restarts, isopropyl alcohol pads.
Wiping down the disc multiple times to see if we could fix it.
Yeah.
Realizing
it was warped.
Yeah.
Maybe I finally get into the wonderful world of restorative plastic polish.
Yeah.
This could be the guinea pig. This could be the Leica that we shoot out in the space and see if this Laserdisc will work. Yeah. And even panic buying a VHS on eBay that's going to be here 5 days after this podcast has been posted. But
and it's kind of appropriate for this film because it's like this film of like a journey of pain. And boy, did we go through a journey of pain trying to finish this movie.
Yes, the things that we did to get this podcast to you today.
Which, however, if you're into obsolete formats, is the reality of your existence.
Yes, sometimes you need to, you know, isopropyl alcohol. Sometimes you need a backup machine.
Yeah. Don't ask us why we have two. But we have two laser discs.
The second one was so cheap.
And two Betamax players.
That's a parts machine. And we have three CED players.
And three CDs.
All three the same model. So I have two parts machines to keep this format going well into the future.
And at least like three VCRs, I think. So we're
something like that, yeah. We have a couple. Not all the same model, though, unfortunately. Yeah. So
this is also be prepared for having multiple machines.
Yes. Learn how to change belts. Learn isopropyl, the uses of isopropyl alcohol.
Which on a positive, you do have to say, at least to some degree, you can fix them, right? Like because of belts and things like that, you can to some degree fix them.
Yes.
So now that we went through the trauma of trying to watch The Crow... I guess we could talk about The Crow itself.
Let's talk about the movie. I guess we should talk about it in the context of 94.
Yeah.
Because I might have been in a college dorm room the last time I saw this movie. Or
off-campus
house that I was living in. So I
graduated high school in 94. And so it was very much a part of Gen Xer existence watching this film. And I'm with you. It's probably been... 20 years, maybe, since I've watched this particular movie.
Yeah, and of course, you know, part of it, pre-internet, the world of the urban legend, of course, Brandon Lee unfortunately passed away while shooting the film in a just absolutely tragic accident.
Yeah. Which became an urban legend that this film is cursed.
It became an urban legend that this film is cursed. I remember people talking about, like, well, what scene did it happen in? And did they actually use the footage?
And that was a part of the rumor for the long time, that they actually kept the footage in where he died.
Which,
They
did not. And, I mean, how horrifically cynical. I was looking at the back cover of the Laserdisc. The year's most talked about film! In exclamation point, the biggest font, or the biggest bright font. We all know why people were talking about this film and why this film, other than being, you know, supposedly a cool movie or a movie that would have had hype no matter what, then took on this darker urban legend category, which again made, this was one of those of that era, I think the home video era, you know, where you have to go get it and you have to know somebody, or if your dorm life's, I had a roommate who had it. Hi, Dave. You know,
who Dave like watched it all the time.
They watched it a few times. Dave listens to this podcast.
A Demon Knight was also in that rotation.
Demon Knight, Vampire Hunter D, Akira. Love
part
you, Dave.
Of, part of those rotations of films.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so it was an event. Oh, we're going to see The Crow. Yeah. It's going to be this thing. Which now, watching it for the first time in the 21st century, here we are. What do we think?
Yeah. So I think, you know, Matt and I, so it took us so long to get to watch it. We did do our podcast after watching it, which also gives you time to process.
Yeah.
And so thinking about this, and I'm not going to say I'm an expert on adaptations of comics or graphic novels, but if you think about it, at the time, there was not many successful adaptations. So, like, you know,
they
like,
could still be hit or miss.
Yeah,
today.
I mean, but I think in the sense of like Superman with Christopher Reeve for me is just so hokey. And then you had Batman, and Tim Burton created this really dark universe. But the Joker is still a bit hokey, right?
Yes.
Like, I think Michael Keaton did an amazing job as Batman. But it, there's still that hokey element to it. And then you think about the 90s. So you had The Crow, Tank Girl, Spawn. They were three kind of adaptations of comic books. Like, I don't feel like fully successful. Part of a great evolution, right? And I think once you get to, like, the X-Men, but especially for me, Iron Man, where you had an indie, really successful indie director paired with an amazing actor, where you finally had this comic book adaptation kind of come together in a really good way. Still, like, hit or miss, but I do think that people have found a stride in how to correctly adapt comic books to film. So in looking at this movie, And having time away from it, the one thing that really was a struggle for me in rewatching it, and you rewatch it and you know, like, he died making this film. Brandon Lee died making this film. But it's not, for me, not a very successful adaptation.
Yeah.
And I think that part of the reason why people so liked it is, compared to other comic book adaptations prior to this, this seemed like, oh, wow, like, they're trying to get it. This is a progression, so I get that. Also, your early 90s, you're coming out of the hokey horror film phase, where it was, you know, Freddy and all that other stuff that can kind of be very, these horror films being very hokey. And we get into the 90s where there is starting to be a change in horror films. So you have, like, Flatliners, that's a little bit more serious. Jacob's Ladder, we're getting into Misery and Dolores Claiborne, People Under the Stairs, Candyman is 92, which I adore Candyman. So we're seeing in the 90s, like, this shift from the hokiness of the 80s horror into, like, this more serious attitude. So I think a part of why people liked it is just the time and place, because there was a lot of cheese factors to it. But for me, it's not a successful adaptation. I don't know the comic book fully well, but I will say the part that really bothered me was a lack of tension. And I think I mentioned this to you already, this lack of tension.
Which explained the whole film to me. There was, like, there was something that felt off, and your theory on this
And I
was,
think,
like, a light bulb going off.
Yeah, the thing that really, as a fan of horror movies, as a fan of thrillers, as a fan of some comic book films, there's often these parameters and these tensions that are built in. And so there's no tension. Like, he literally rises from the dead. He is completely invincible. He is an enhanced human being. He can run, and he knows suddenly karate and martial arts.
Can fall off buildings and be fine.
Not an issue. And so it's inevitable that he's going to find the people that you know, killed him and his fiance, and exact his revenge. But there's no tension there. So it's not time bound. And I believe Shelley died. Now, I think, which is a change from the comic book. I think in the comic book, Shelley died immediately, but he was in the hospital, and it took him like 30 to 36 hours to die. They reversed it. He dies immediately in the movie, and Shelley is in the hospital for a period of time. But it's not time-bound. So, like, he only has 30 hours, because that's the amount of time that this happened. He has 30 hours between when they were attacked and died to get this done. That would have built a tension. Or that he had to make a Faustian deal to come back to exact his revenge, and that he might lose his immortal soul for doing this.
Yeah.
Or that he might get stuck in limbo forever because he needs to exact this revenge, and he gets lost in the vengeance and loses his humanity.
Yeah.
Now, the Skull Cowboy, who is a big figure in the comic book, who had to be eliminated from this film because of Brandon Lee's untimely death, I don't know if he would have helped build that tension. I don't know. But there, for me, there was no tension. You knew it was going to happen. Like, there wasn't anything.
It was almost like a sitcom.
Yeah.
Like, you knew at the end, and yeah, this explains it so perfectly, especially having watched the film more than once. You get a sense, oh, by the end, you know, so it's almost like it is that Superman hokiness.
Yeah.
Now, there is a kryptonite, but the kryptonite comes
at the very end of the film.
At the very end of the film.
When it's convenient for it to happen.
Which is actually in the 18-chapter Laserdisc, chapter 17.
Yeah.
Suddenly you find out, oh, if the Crow is injured, he's no longer immortal.
Yeah.
But that even comes after the super violent boardroom scene where the Brandon Lee character is shot probably 100 times and is perfectly fine and still throwing people out windows and like catching swords with his bare hands and doing all the you know, physical action elements of you know, he you find that out, so they save that for the end of the film.
Yeah, so you basically find out that the crow bird is his companion, and not so, in the comic, but not so much the.
It's the companion movie. And his power.
It's his companion. His companion in the comic book, he's also the one who goads him to it. But you find out that if the bird, his companion bird, is injured, then he can't. Then he gets injured too. That's told, very end of the film. That's just that plot point is brought up, which would have built tension, right? Like, if there's something in the beginning of the film where the bird was
or
injured.
Or every time the bird's in peril.
He's in peril. Like, something happens. You know, but the reality is, like, if you know that if you get shot and your wounds are cleaned up, why don't you just show up at the bar where the bad guys are? Just kill all four of them right then and there, and you're done. Boom. Back. You know, back. You're back where you belong. That doesn't make much of a film, but. So they kind of throw in this, like, random all of a sudden. And then also you find out that... Sorry, this really annoyed me. Like, I hate stuff like this. Where he's... so he dispatches of the four men who directly murdered him and raped and murdered his fiance. He just dispatches of those four men. And then he's left with their boss. Like, the big crime boss. Which... So I just laughed. Like, we're watching the movie. And so he goes out onto the roof of the church. Like, he takes the girl. So there's this girl that he and his fiance had been, Eric and his wife, fiance Shelley, had befriended. The big bad guy, Top Dollar, I think was his name, takes Shelley, kidnaps her to get to the Crow. And is trying to escape the Crow, so he goes out onto the roof of the church. But I just started laughing because it just seems so ridiculous. But they're fighting, and the way he defeats the bad guy, because now he's mortal, because the bad guy knew if he hurt the Crow.
Yes.
There's
a magic minority.
There's a magic minority,
and the magic minority figures out.
If you hurt the Crow.
Because she's mystical, because she's a minority.
She's Chinese, or...
Asian.
Asian. So they know that if you injure the Crow, he's weakened. And so he's battling. The way he defeats him, he's like, now you get Shelley's 30 hours of pain. He, like, grabs him and gives it to him. And I hate that kind of stuff, right?
Yes.
Like, I hate that kind of stuff. Because if he was being tortured by experiencing her 30 hours of pain, then why wasn't that a component of the whole film?
And he, throughout the film, he is a receiver.
Yeah.
He touches people, he touches objects.
Yeah.
He gets full-bodied, full sensory memories.
Yeah.
You don't necessarily get a sense that he can broadcast.
Right.
Either.
Right, and he can suddenly and now again, can broadcast. It's through,
I mean, so we say that, and I will say the other thing we should, full disclosure, preface, that before we watched The Crow, we watched on Shudder, the streaming service Shudder, the wonderful, interesting, compelling series Cursed Films.
Yeah.
Which...
Highly recommend.
Highly recommend if you have the Shudder streaming app. I mean, Cursed Films and Joe Bob Briggs are, I think, worth it just itself.
Yeah.
At least for a month. whatever. Just binge all that and then, you know. But no, we enjoy our... We stream movies. We're not complete Stone Age people.
Right.
But we rewatched the Cursed Films piece on The Crow.
Yeah.
And the other part that's really fascinating is that Michael Berryman was supposed to be the cowboy, the skull cowboy.
You know Michael Berryman. He's in, like, all these horror films.
He was the bald dude in The Hills Have Eyes.
Yeah.
On the DVD VHS box cover, that's Michael Berryman.
Yeah.
That's his name. You know his face. That's now his name.
Yeah.
Who was incredibly insightful, and perhaps the most incredibly insightful person that they talked to.
Yeah.
So he was supposed to be in the film.
And he had showed up at the beginning of filming to do a scene and get all the prosthetics done.
Yes.
He was supposed to come at the end of the filming to finish his scene.
Yeah, and so he was supposed to, those were the scenes that were cut because, you know, of the Brandon Lee accident.
Yeah.
And the two big things that he mentions, or the insightful things, one is that they shot The Crow in North Carolina. North Carolina's a right-to-work state, an anti-union state.
Yeah.
And so he talks about, you know, the danger on a movie set when people are tired and overworked. And not fully qualified, you know, would have happened if they shot the film in California or something, or Pennsylvania or wherever. Which I think is really important to bring the labor aspect of filmmaking into it, is like as far as what happened with the accident.
Yeah.
Yeah, and if anybody cares, it's the scene where they're actually doing the home invasion where Brandon Lee's character dies and Shelley dies. It was shooting that scene was the scene.
Yeah.
It was a projectile left in a weapon, in the barrel of a weapon, and, you know, going from blanks to dummies to...
Yeah. So it was a part of a blank that had been lodged and...
Yeah.
When the gun had not been checked.
But the other thing Michael Berryman talked about, which I think is fascinating, which almost redeems the film for me, is this question of, you know, the story of The Crow and the story of James O'Barr's comic book.
Right.
That here was someone who lost a fiancé to a drunk driver. And as part of his therapy, as part of his rebuilding himself, he created this Crow character. And there's something, for me, that I will say, a movie that doesn't date well, there is something that's so elemental in this film about this notion of justice, or is it vengeance, or that... You know, and in a sense, the Crow is a messenger from heaven, really.
Mm-hmm.
Though it's this dark, gothy movie, that there's this, you know, what do you do with the evil in creation?
Right.
And for me, that there's something that's so elemental in the film.
Well, I think
that still makes it kind of compelling, in spite of these flaws that we don't know. Also, if they had been able to shoot all of the scenes.
Yeah, or if it could have also been, was it a poor adaptation? I mean,
we'll never know.
The screenwriters for it are not really, if you look at their history, they actually are like, they wrote horror novels and other stuff. And steampunk stuff, and yeah. they really don't have a career much after The Crow.
Yeah.
So you have your two screenwriters who are more steampunk people, who maybe you can see that aesthetic, the dark aesthetic with it, but maybe it was also just not a successful adaptation.
Yeah.
And then also, you know, as we said, the view of the curse around it, and that it's, you know, Brandon Lee with his father dying under mysterious circumstances, Brandon Lee dying under mysterious circumstances, you kind of, all the other stuff gets lost.
Yeah.
And at the core of it, it's really tragic. So you have the creator who, he wrote this comic because the love of his life tragically died.
Yes.
And then the Crow, Shelley, tragically dies, and he tragically dies. Brandon Lee was engaged at the time, tragically dies, and his fiance is left without her partner, right? And so you have these, like, lives that have been ripped apart around this film, around this concept, that's really lost around the curse of the film.
Yeah.
And there's, like, a beauty and a tragedy in that beauty, and that's heartbreaking.
Yeah.
That is really heartbreaking. And when Michael Berryman was talking about that in the Cursed series, it was really painful and really touching to think of it within those terms.
Yeah.
In some ways, I feel like... And the director who directed this, like, he had directed a lot of videos at that time. He did Crowded's House, Don't Dream It's Over. But he directed videos. And he did Dark City, which I haven't seen, but that Dark City has a really good reputation. He also did iRobot. But The Crow was kind of his first big budget film.
Yeah.
And so I think you had like a young, like an inexperienced director, maybe not a great screenwriter, super, super low budget. In a way, I would love to see this movie redone with a stronger writer, a stronger script, and a stronger director.
Yeah.
I think it could be a heartbreaking film. But I think that's missed. Like, the heartbreak is kind of missed
it. And there's, just a lot of action. A lot of action, but no danger and no peril.
Right.
You know, I will say, you know, saying that he's a video director, I think, gives me some insight on... There's some really nice shots. I mean, it can be in places, if you have enough suspension of disbelief, it can be in places a very visually rich film.
Yeah.
But, yeah, if you're a really good video director, you can set up a shot and you can have some great quick editing sequences.
Yeah.
And there's bands in this movie. There's a couple of rock and roll club shows, and you know, now you think about it, those bands are shot like they would be shot for a music video.
Yeah.
And they sound really good. I think you also have to mention the soundtrack.
You can't forget the soundtrack.
Can't forget the soundtrack. If there was ever a cassette that belonged in a hand-me-down from your grandmother's 1987 Toyota Camry center armrest, it's the Crow soundtrack cassette or the CD. I was even thinking of Graham Revell. Did the score, which I have the score on cassette, as well as the soundtrack on cassette and CD. You know, he set himself up for a streak of basically every edgy, dark film he did the score for the next, say, 20 years. And he is still actively making music for films and television. But that soundtrack, which was also sort of like, goth industrial 101, you got The Cure, got Nine Inch Nails covering Joy Division, the Rollins Band covering Suicide, Pantera covering Poison Idea. You have all of these, like, this window to this world of
Stone Temple Pilots,
I think, were the big hit. I mean, Rage Against the Machine, their trajectory was just beginning.
I will say, though, it was hard. Dead Souls, Joy Division, love that song.
Uh-huh.
I wasn't fully loving the cover, but I'll go with it.
Yeah, and then Badge is better by Poison Idea.
Yeah.
But again, that was part of the zeitgeist of 94. I mean, if you were a counterculture youth, I was a counterculture youth.
Yeah.
This film was a must-see. That soundtrack was a must-own. I think you can make that joke from Wayne's World. You know, nobody bought it. If you were a suburban kid, nobody bought that thing. It was just kind of issued to you.
It just magically appeared.
I think my CD came from a Pathmark.
Wow.
I think I bought this CD at Pathmark grocery store.
Wow. That's something. That
yeah. Because they would have like a few little section of CDs, and I managed to slip that one into the cart, I think.
Can I mention that this is kind of, I just thought it was amusing. One of the screenwriters was a lyricist for the Blue Oyster Cult.
Wow.
Yeah, sorry. Kind of interesting, and he went on to write the crowd.
No, that's shambolic.
Yeah.
Which, yeah. Again, is maybe the double tragedy of this. Does this compound, you know, you can only experience this film knowing that the star died.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's hard to, it's even hard for me to say this right now. It's not a great piece of art.
No.
You know, I even whispered that.
Yeah.
But it's not a great piece of art.
Well, I think it's okay. I mean, I think you're
it's
not.
Okay.
I don't think you're dishonoring Brandon Lee. Do I think Brandon Lee did a good job with the material and the direction he was probably
giving? Oh, yes.
Yeah,
oh,
I think he did.
Both the acting and also the physicality of that role,
yeah.
He was so good, and that this should have been the film that set him up for
future stardom,
future amazing films. He you know, this, you can see that the sky really was the limit for him through this film.
So I don't think there's anything wrong with saying it's a flawed film. His performance was really good, but I think there was scripting issues.
Soundtrack was really good.
His acting and the soundtrack are definitely worth it.
That is some visually fun. I mean, if you almost experience it not as a narrative film, but as a painting that moves.
Yeah.
There are elements that are just kind of fun to look at.
If you want, and then if you want a better, like for me, if like you want a really good revenge film, like go to I Spit on Your Grave, The Last House on the Left, Kill Bill. Like there are so many better
revenge films
out there.
There's
so many
better
gothic horror films out there.
Yeah.
But I do think Brandon Lee did a really great job in the film. The soundtrack is amazing. There's some really good visuals, but it's a very flawed film.
Yeah.
It really is a flawed film, and I don't think it's just because of his death.
No.
Because he actually died pretty late into the filming of the movie. I think some of it definitely was scripting issues and direction issues.
Yeah.
Do you want to move on to bottom five?
Oh, do you want to move on to bottom five? Though I want to also mention Ernie Hudson's in this movie. Hudson's the buddy cop. Ernie Hudson, you know, Ghostbusters, Ernie Hudson.
Who doesn't adore Ernie Hudson?
And we forget that Ernie Hudson's in The Crow.
We do.
He's an important part of The Crow.
He is. I adore Ernie Hudson. Oh, we also forgot to mention that Luther from The Warriors was in this film.
Oh.
The one who says, "Warriors, come out to play."
Yes.
Luther is in this film, which he probably would have been a much better top crime boss than the crime boss that we...
Yes.
Oh, I forgot to mention. Can I mention that before we go into the top? To the bottom.
Yeah, go for it.
I didn't want, like, the actor who played the crime boss.
Yeah.
I'm going to say this. We'll get into it. I'll mention part of the reason. But there wasn't anything really menacing about him.
No.
And it's just, I don't know. I just didn't
think...
This really is
a dark Superman film.
Yeah.
That's all it is.
Yeah.
It's a Superman film shot at night.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it.
That's what it is. So let's move on to the bottom five. Or the big five questions. Sorry, wrong podcast.
Oops, sorry. My fault.
It's okay. Is it camp, retro, a classic, or just an old movie?
I feel like it's... For me, I'm partially going to put it in retro because it does feel the time and the place in the 90s where like there was the goth and emo phase happening and kind of this shift to more like... darker films, because you would have had Reservoir Dogs, Pulp Fiction came out the same time.
Yeah.
So you kind of had this like darker tone, Boondock Saints, like you kind of had this darker tone that was seeping in. So it does really, for me, still feel like very much of a time and a place.
Yeah, same. It's retro. I wonder, you know, someone who works primarily with 18-year-olds, what would happen if you showed them this film?
They'd probably laugh.
They might laugh at it, or they might be like, what the hell is... I mean, it would be like for our generation when, you know, people showed us stuff from the 60s.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I observed somebody in the last decade, a colleague who like started with Jimi Hendrix at Woodstock one day, you know, and it was just like, the students were just like, who is that guy? What is this? You know?
Yeah.
I think some people might think it's cool because people do like, you know, retro culture and things with a sense of pastishness. I would call it pastishness, you know. But yeah, I think a lot of people would be like, this has been done since so much better.
Right. I mean, it's like you take like, say, Vincent Price, House on Haunted Hill, and it's cheesy as hell.
Yeah.
But people adored it and thought it was scary. You watch it now, even watching in the 90s, I was like, really? It's so, so cheesy. I do think 18-year-olds would find this kind of cheesy.
Yeah.
However, there is that element of, and I remember being in my teens, and that kind of sense of like, Brandon Lee, Eric Draven loves his fiancée so, so much that he comes back from death. There's something about a teenager angst that does really speak to.
Yeah, and you know, again, having watched this in the shadow of having watched cursed films, there is something just purely elemental about the idea of a love that transcends death.
Right.
That is still weirdly touching. It's a retro film. So what about the social political distance? I mentioned earlier there is a magic minority who knows the ways of the mystic things.
Yes, so there's magic minority.
But, you know, that's the one.
That's the one. But, I mean, Ernie Hudson obviously is black. And then,
yeah, and it's just this kind of straight, fully developed character.
Yeah, and then you have one of the thugs is black, is Tintin, I think was his name Tintin. But to be honest with you, like, these kind of films, like you think about like Judgment Night, and typically the urban thug is going to be black.
Yeah.
And that actually is not the case. Like the urban thugs are actually diverse. Ernie Hudson and the other, you know, there's
the African American cop.
There's diversity in the cops. You know, I mean, Brandon Lee is part Asian, right? I mean, so he is biracial. So, in the sense of it, like, being...
In sense of casting.
Casting, like, it is actually kind of interestingly cast, right?
Yeah.
And, like, it's not what you would typically think of being cast. So I found actually that kind of fascinating.
I found that fascinating. I will say part of the other thing I was thinking about is the way that we think about urban space, or the way especially older people think about urban space.
Yeah.
That this definitely is, you know... The only city you can conceive of is 1970s The Bronx.
Yeah.
It very much heavily weighs on that trope.
Yeah.
Now, granted, that was a time when I think irrational fear of urban America was completely mainstream.
Yeah.
You know, white flight was still the most normal, rational thing you could do. And again, as kids from the suburbs... There's something about The Crow that maybe plays into that. Oh, there's that place near us. It's exciting, but it's also dangerous.
Yeah.
Which, you know, that's how my boomer mother still conceives of urban space. It's at Pittsburgh. Any city, Pittsburgh, Philadelphia, New York, is 1970s The Bronx. It's on fire. You will get mugged. You know, and again, there's this, you know, tragic history of urban space in America and its abandonment and what parasitic development does to urban space. But that to me sounds, especially as someone who's now lived in a city since 2000.
Yeah.
And it, you know, we now have this other narrative of gentrification that, you know, would happen. They would be thrown out the window. If they made The Crow today, they'd be thrown out the window of a brand new condominium or something.
Yeah.
Or, you know, whatever. So that's a little bit of a superstitious nightmare of America that I think I'm reminded of when I see this film.
I also am going to say the females are problematic in this film. Shelley is non-existent. Like, I don't know if it's partially because Brandon Lee's death, But, like, really, you get a couple scenes of her smiling.
Yeah.
And that's it. And then, you know, Sarah is the girl. Her mom is a severe drug addict. And then the other woman in the film is the mystic Asian. It's very weird to me, kind of the betrayal of women mm-hmm. in this film. And that there's also the feminist in me of, like, you know, Shelley, if Shelley was really pissed off about how she died, why didn't she just come back and avenge her life?
Yeah, why wasn't it her? Yeah.
And why wasn't it her, or why wasn't she a partner with him, or anything like that? Like, so...
Again, she shows up in the last scene of the film.
She does. I mean, there's a couple flashback scenes where you kind of see her smile, and that's about it. And then you see her at the end coming to him. So that's kind of, like, weird for me, and maybe also part of the issue of the scripting... Is it he comes back for revenge, or does he come back because he's so guilt-ridden by how she died?
Mm.
And I think that actually is brought out closer in the comic book, that it's more that he's guilt-ridden. And that when I was reading more about the comic, is that he actually is mutilating himself, he's doing all this other stuff, and so he's really struggling with the guilt of her death. And it's not necessarily about vengeance. It's about he came back because he felt so guilty about how she died. But for me, that was really problematic. She was really not in the film. And when I first saw this film, again, teenage angst, where you're like, that kind of, you know, like this endless love, that this is gorgeous, mm-hmm. this is beautiful, he came back. But she's really a non-entity. So it's hard to be like understanding why he came back and why it was so urgent for him to come back, because she was such a non-entity in the film.
Yes. So question three, the technical distance.
Oof. So it feels, for me, it feels like they saw Blade Runner and they're like, wow, dude, that's awesome. And then they just didn't have the money to do Blade Runner.
Yeah.
So they use miniatures a lot for the cityscapes, and it's really noticeable now. Like, you can really tell...
Even on Laserdisc.
Yeah, you could really
And when
tell.
We did switch over for the last 20 minutes to, you know, 1080p streaming.
this is so funny. I know this is silly. The wigs are really bad in this. Mm-hmm. Like, Fun Boy's wig is horrific. Top Dollar, the big crime boss... This wig is really bad.
Yeah.
Like, there's just, like, Brandon, now, granted, like, so the Brandon Lee, the crow, when he's the crow, when he comes back as the crow, his makeup is very simple, but it's actually effective. Like, I think his makeup is really good, but everything else is so, like, oh my goodness. Like, you just look at it and you're like, really? In this scene, I was just like, just grab his weave. Just pull his weave off. That's that big fight scene. That's what was going through my head. So there's just, like, stuff like that that's kind of
Which
weird.
Maybe, you know, question four, the room test, is the wigs.
The wigs, yeah. The wigs are so, so, so bad. They're, like, really, really bad.
So, question five, is it a keeper? Which, in this case... Well, I mean, the Laserdisc is shot. Unplayable.
It's unplayable. We did buy the VHS.
We will have a VHS tape. What do we do with that VHS tape?
So I guess for me, like, I will come back to the cynical me who, like, looks at the script, but the part of me that does want to believe in true love and love everlasting, mm-hmm. there is a part in my heart that is like, wow, that mm-hmm. is really... with James Ibar when he went through to have this, like, there is a part of me that really is like, aw,
mm-hmm.
there's this aw about it, but then technically there's lots of problems with this movie. As I mentioned multiple times, I think they're really poor scriptwriters. And for me, like, I think that litmus test is always when you have a film that has problems, but there's parts of it that are successful. You can look at the director or the screenwriters and see the path that they took. And oftentimes people in the know or people in the industry are like, this was successful for this reason, and those people are then often picked to do other things and be able to move on. Now I know there's people going to be like, but I loved iRobot. I hated iRobot. Like I hated iRobot. So I think like I look at the director and I look at the script writers, and they really haven't gone on to do these great big things. And so I think everybody kind of knew it wasn't a really successful film, because those people really didn't go on to these really bright, promising careers. So because of 90, because it's retro, 90 nostalgia, will I forever now keep that VHS tape in our collection? Absolutely.
Same.
Yeah.
Same. Maybe another 20 years, maybe we'll see this movie again.
Yeah.
But, yeah. Yeah.
And I think that's a wrap.
That is a wrap.
All right.
All right. Thank you very much, folks.